Hi everyone, my name is Mr. Barlow and welcome to episode 18 of the VCE Biology Podcast. This episode covers part of Unit 2, Area of Study 1, and I'll be talking about the reproductive strategies that animals use to ensure their ongoing survival. So in a podcast about the reproductive strategies of animals, it's probably best to start talking about the life cycle of sexually reproducing organisms. So that's also known as the alternation of generations. So most animals are diploid, and this means that they've got two sets of chromosomes, one set from their mother and one set from their father. So then that organism grows and develops until it gets to an age where it can reproduce, you know, for itself. And what happens then is that that organism produces a sex cell or a gamete, and that gamete is haploid, and that means it's only got one set of chromosomes. So then that gamete fuses with another gamete via a process called fertilization to produce a new animal which grows and develops until it gets to a reproductive age, and then it produces another haploid cell, another gamete, which fertilizes with an egg or sperm, to produce a new diploid animal, which grows and develops until it gets to a reproductive age, and then it can produce another gamete, and so on and so on and so forth. So basically, this alternation between a diploid organism and a haploid gamete is known as the alternation of generations. Now, when people think about a haploid sperm cell fusing together with a haploid egg cell to form a diploid cell known as a zygote, they normally only think of one thing. But there's actually a wide variety of reproductive strategies. For example, fertilization of the egg and the sperm can actually occur either externally or internally. So internal fertilization is going to involve some sort of copulation or mating, where the sperm is basically deposited inside the reproductive tract of the female. Then the sperm and the egg meet, and then, you know, development into a new organism continues. Or external fertilization can occur, and this normally happens in aquatic animals or aquatic environments. So what happens is, in terms of external fertilizing animals, those organisms normally release millions of eggs and sperm into the same area of water and just kind of hope that one sperm meets up with one of the eggs at some stage while they're just floating around in the water. So that's, you know, the difference between internal fertilization and external fertilization. Now, the amount of nutrition that the parents provide their newly formed zygotes also varies greatly. For example, sea urchins, which release millions of sperm and egg into the same area of water to undergo external fertilization, they can't provide nutrition to all of those millions of sperm or egg. So basically, once a zygote is formed, it's on its own. The newly formed tiny organism must feed itself to provide food for further growth. So when, you know, newly formed organisms are provided with a very small amount of nutrition by their parents, it's known as indirect development, and it's associated with very small amounts of yolk in the egg cells. You know, so yolk is kind of the energy store for the early growth of an organism, so there's not much yolk. Indirect development also involves the development of the organism into a small swimming larva. So the larvae feed and grow, you know, while swimming around in the water, getting their own food. And then when they've done that enough, they undergo something called metamorphosis. And when the larva, you know, goes through metamorphosis, which is a type of change, it's then that it basically takes on its adult form. So sea urchins do this indirect development, and frogs also do indirect development, and tadpoles are the larval stage of frogs. So that's indirect development, but there's also direct development. And this is basically where an individual is hatched or born into basically an adult form. For example, birds, Basically, the zygote is in an egg in birds, and that egg is full of yolk. So that's the energy or nutrition for the growing organism to use to grow into an adult form. So that's why it's direct development, because they're directly provided with energy or nutrition. And humans or mammals, our zygote is implanted in the wall of the uterus, and the mother in a mammal provides heaps of nutrition for the entire gestational period for that new developing organism. So again, in mammalian offspring, the offspring are born into the world into basically an adult form. Babies aren't really adults, but they've got the pretty much the same shape. So that's basically direct development. Parents provide a great deal of nutrition for the growing organism. Now, if you're an aquatic animal and you're about to release millions of your gametes into the ocean, you kind of want to do it when someone of the opposite sex is about to release their gametes too. So what do you do? How do you make sure that your gametes are going to meet up with some other gametes, fuse to form a diploid zygote, and then, go through indirect development to make a new organism? Well, what organisms like that do is that they coordinate the release of their gametes to occur at a particular time. And the way that they do that is they use both chemical communication with each other, but they also respond to environmental cues. So, they might release their gametes at a particular time of day, so maybe just after darkness, but also at a particular time of year, maybe when there's going to be lots of food around to give their young the best chance of survival. So, they time their reproduction. So, in fact, aquatic animals aren't the only animals that time their reproduction. So, mammals actually do it too. For example, dogs can actually only successfully reproduce when a female dog is on heat. And the reason for that is that her eggs are not ready for fertilization unless she's on heat. So, in fact, lots of organisms time their reproduction to basically make sure that they've got the biggest chance of being successful in creating a new organism. So, obviously, animals want to ensure that their reproductive efforts are successful. And they actually engage in a number of reproductive behaviors to ensure just that. So, for example, an animal will only mate with another animal that has the right physical appearance. And that's obviously for a couple of reasons. The first one is to make sure that they're mating with an animal of the right species, which is pretty important. If two animals of different species reproduce, you don't get viable offspring. But it's also important to ensure that they're mating with someone whose physiological state is right or correct, and their mating is most likely to be successful. Other reproductive behaviors, there's quite a lot of courtship behaviors. So animals will court one another, and that's basically to ensure that the animal gets the best quality mate and that the ensuing offspring has the best chance of survival. And some animals, like gorillas, there's a dominant alpha male in the group, and females will be more likely to mate with that dominant male, and that's again, the dominant male is in theory more likely to produce better quality offspring. So all these different behaviors that animals, partake in to ensure that they reproduce with the best quality mate available is basically to ensure that their genes have the best possible chance of making it through to the next generation. So, if you reproduce with a high quality mate and then that mating is successful, it produces an offspring, that offspring has got high quality genes, then they'll survive in their environment, and then, yeah, your genes will have been passed on to the next generation. And that's really what life's all about. So I've been talking all about reproduction, but successful reproduction is only a part of the story for lots of animals. And that's because different animals provide their embryos with vastly different amounts of protection, and different animals also provide their young with vastly different amounts of parental care. So, for example, some animals give their young and their embryos zero care or protection. So that's, your aquatic animals that just release their sperm and eggs into the ocean. Some animals, again, give their young and their embryos quite a bit of care. So, birds might sit on their eggs while they develop, and then they might help their young by feeding them when they're very little. Some organisms, some animals will let their young, like birds, hang around them while they grow up, and they'll do it for different extents of time. And some animals, for example, mammals or humans, will provide their young with heaps of care. So, mammals are nourished by milk. So the provision of milk can go for months or even years. But even after that, certainly in young humans, the provision of parental care can continue for, kind of at least 15 years, and often a lot longer than that. So there's actually a lot of difference between the amount, in the amounts of care that different animals provide their young. So the difference in this amount of care can actually be explained by something called the RK selection theory. So basically, animals that use R selection can produce huge numbers of organisms and don't provide much parental care to their young. Animals that use K selection don't produce many offspring, don't produce many young, but they provide an enormous amount of care to their offspring. And obviously, both R selection and K selection can be a successful reproductive strategy in differing environments. Now, in humans, reproduction is not just left up to chance anymore. And that's basically because we are so smart, we've developed a whole range of technologies that have enabled us to intervene in our own reproduction. For example, if a couple is having trouble reproducing, they can partake in something called IVF, which stands for in vitro fertilization. So in vitro basically means in glass, pretty much. So what IVF stands for, it stands for basically getting a sperm from a man and then an egg from a woman and putting them together or fertilizing them in the lab or in glassware. So the success rates of IVF aren't really very high, but it's really good for couples who are having trouble reproducing. There's also lots of tests that we can do on our young, and what I mean by young is before they're born, so it's prenatal testing. So in terms of testing, for example, in IVF, you can actually test a woman's eggs before you even go through the fertilization process. So the reason you can do this is in meiosis, when female gametes, egg cells are produced, meiosis actually produces four cells. So only one of those cells ends up being an egg cell. The other three are called polar bodies. So what you can do is you can remove one of those polar bodies, and then you can test that polar body, and that'll basically give you an indication of any genetic defects that are present in the DNA of the egg cell. So another prenatal test you can do if fertilization has occurred in vitro is that you can actually remove one of the cells of the developing embryo and test it for genetic defects. So the reason you can do that is once the sperm fuses with the egg to form a zygote, the zygote will replicate via mitosis to form two cells. Then those two cells will replicate via mitosis to form four cells. They'll replicate to form eight, they'll replicate to form 16, and so on for a relatively short period of time. But all of those early cells are the same, and they're called stem cells. And any of those cells can form into any other type of cell. So that very early collection of cells is called a blastocyst. And if you can get one of the cells from the blastocyst very early on, you can test that and then basically establish the genetic makeup of that newly formed organism, which is amazing. Another type of prenatal testing is amniocentesis. So this basically involves removing a small sample of fluid from around the fetus. So this fluid is kept around the fetus, in fact, by a small membrane called the amnion. So this fluid is kind of kept inside the amniotic cavity. So the fluid actually contains some of the developing fetus's skin cells. So when you remove some amniotic fluid via amniocentesis, you can then test those cells to see if the developing fetus has any genetic abnormalities, like, for example, Down syndrome. So another prenatal test, and this is again testing the genetic makeup of the fetus, is chorionic villus sampling, or CVS. And this involves removing a small sample of fetus tissue. So, unsurprisingly, the tissue is called chorionic villi, and then you test that tissue for any genetic defects. And the last type of prenatal test I'll talk about is ultrasound. So ultrasound basically involves bouncing sound waves off the baby inside the womb, you know, in the uterus. This is a completely safe test, so unlike amniocentesis and CVS, which both carry some small chance of miscarriage, ultrasound you can, you know, use very safely, and you use it basically to, you know, to check the baby out while it's still in the womb, and that's pretty cool. Now, because humans are so smart, we've even developed technologies that'll help keep babies alive if they've been born prematurely. And also, lastly but not least, when you talk about human intelligence and things that we've developed, we've even developed basically birth control. So that is a way of intervening in reproduction so that it doesn't happen. That is how far we have come. Now, the last thing I want to talk about in this episode is reproductive strategies in plants. So plants can either use self-fertilization. So this is when the pollen, so this is basically the sperm of a plant, fertilizes its own egg. And this is a form of asexual reproduction. Plants can also engage in cross-fertilization. So this is when the pollen of one plant fertilizes a different plant. And plants also sometimes use no fertilization. So this is basically when the egg of a plant just grows and develops and makes a whole new plant, pretty much. So out of those three plant fertilization strategies, both self-fertilization and no fertilization, well, they're good because, you know, the plant doesn't need to, you know, find a mate or find pollen from another plant. But those two fertilization strategies are bad in that they don't increase the genetic diversity of the species. So, you know, cross-pollination does increase genetic diversity, and that's got a big advantage because a large genetic diversity is really important for the entire species' survival. So, a bit like animals, the provision of nutrients to newly formed plants is also different between different plant species. So in some plants, the newly fertilized seed will just kind of float off in the wind and it'll be kind of like, good luck to you, buddy. But other plants will provide their seeds with a great deal of nutrition, their early embryos. So the example of that is fruit. So fruit is basically the ripened ovary together with the seed of a flowering plant. So yeah, I mean, think about that next time you take a bite of an apple. You're actually chowing down on the ripened ovary of a plant. There you go. And that lovely thought brings episode 18 of the VCE Biology Podcast to a close. I'm Mr. Barlow, and thanks for listening.